and welcome to Lang Time Chat, episode 38. And David's over here dancing. So
Lango, everybody.
Ooh, Lango.
That's our new word for hello.
Nice. I will say, like, if you tuned into last month's podcast, you may be thinking, wow, this beginning looks awfully familiar. And it's because this is really a continuation of episode 37. It was sort of accidental. I had so much fun creating this talk, this little discussion about English and its history, and specifically related to borrowing and waves of borrowing, that it didn't fit in an hour.
Are you saying that the first slide of this podcast was borrowed from the last one?
Yes. That was my drum roll. Yes, that is correct.
That's pretty good for a drum major.
Thank you. And so, yeah, we're going to keep talking about waves of borrowing, but just in case it's been a month, maybe you haven't caught up with last month's podcast yet. There's all sorts of reasons that you may have missed out. A little recap from last time is that we talked about borrowing due to specific interactions, specifically borrowings from Latin because of marketplace interactions, so a lot of words related to trade. And this was way long ago on the European continent before the English, what would become English speakers, left the continent. Other types of interactions were through religious spread, and so monks brought more Latin borrowings to England. This is when they were actually over on the British island. So in that era, in the 7th century or thereabouts. There is also a lot of borrowing because of sharing space, where the Norse Vikings came and basically took half the island. And so there's a lot of borrowing from Old Norse. But then the French came and the Norman conquest happened, and that led to more sharing spaces, but in a very different way, where borrowing occurred because there was like a French rulership, and then, you know, people still lived their daily lives in English. And so that's sort of set us up to roughly, we're getting close to all of the waves of borrowing that happened in Middle English. So everything we talked about was really Old English. Once you hit Norman conquest, that's where Middle English is, quote, said to begin. And I say quote because it's not like Middle English suddenly started with the Norman conquest. It's just that's a nice definable moment in history to say, okay, we're gonna go ahead and call this moving forward Middle English. And
what year was that Norman conquest?
1066. There you go.
Good shooting, Sassafras.
It was actually in October of 1066.
Man, so they were all winding down, getting ready to go to sleep for the year.
Oh,
that's when they got him.
Listen, I can tell you this whole, like, there was a whole hubbub. We could have an entire hour-long discussion on just this because let's just say the Anglo-Saxon forces were set up for failure leading up to the Norman conquest for many reasons, but one of which was that as they were waiting for the Normans to actually cross the water to get, because they knew they were coming, and so they were waiting for them, but the water was too choppy and they couldn't cross. It took so long that finally some people were like, I gotta go home and like harvest things. And so they started leaving, and then that's when they came anyway. But it also, like,
and that's why we have toilets in our bathroom.
But there's another added layer in there, because not only were they like going home, but then the Vikings, more Vikings, the Danish ones this time, actually attacked from the north. And so they had to defend up north, and then they actually defeated them. But then right after that, the Normans finally landed. And then so it was a whole mess.
And that's how the Danes got curry.
And did you know that the French actually like brought horses over with them on boats to do this battle?
Just like, was it Noah, or am I thinking of Jim Morrison?
You're thinking of something. All right, so that's where we were last time. that leads us up to a different wave of borrowing. This one that happens really in Middle English, as even throughout early modern English stages, where a lot of words were borrowed because they sounded cool. So they were borrowed for prestige, because at that point, Latin was treated as a learned language. So, you know, the French rule was over, so they weren't borrowing from French anymore, because it was like, well, you're our leaders, we're going to try to work our way up through court systems or whatever. It wasn't because of that. It was really because it's like, if you were really well educated, you learned Latin, and like, just for prestige, all of these words started getting borrowed from Latin. And a lot of them were called inkhorn terms, because that's an inkhorn, where you kept your little pin nibs dipped in ink. Because people said these words as they were coming into English stink of the inkhorn, because it's like, you know, if you're a scholar using these fancy feather nibs and you're bringing in all these words that nobody knows what they mean. And really, so many people didn't know what they mean, that like they were used really what one might argue incorrectly, but so much so that they sort of just started meaning that in English. And so, but some of the words that were borrowed in also never stuck.
I mean, that's really just your gesticulation. You know what I mean?
Just kind of masticate that thought a minute. but yeah, so these, you know, so-called inkhorn terms, by the way, were also where we ended up getting a lot of our derivational prefixes and suffixes that have Latin and even Greek roots, and that we still have as part of our language today, some of which are more productive than others.
By the way, there's a really great character, I don't know if it was just one scene, but from Shakespeare's Much Ado About Nothing, where you can look at this sequence where he's constantly misusing Latin words.
He Dogberry.
Says like, yeah, he says like, I, you know, just arrested these two auspicious individuals. Yeah.
Oh my God. Yes. I love Dogberry. He's like probably my favorite character in that whole thing. But anyway, yeah. So that really did happen though, where a lot of people were just like using these words cause they sounded cool, but not really knowing what they meant. And so, whoops. But some of my, I just pulled out some examples. I love the word fascinate. But if you actually know its history, it was actually used for much more sinister reasons when it, you know, originated in Latin. It actually referred to being bewitched or under a spell, but not like in a good way necessarily. Usually it was used in a much more sinister way. And then its meaning expanded. And so, you know, by the time English really took hold of it, they started using it to refer to just anything that kind of struck your fancy. But I like that word. Yeah. Fascinate. But yeah, its origin is from spells and witchcraft. Another word we got from these inkhorn borrowings was intervene, which is kind of funny. And one of the reasons I use this is because it literally just means like to come between. And obviously in English we have come between. So like we could say this in English without needing to borrow the word, but doesn't intervene just sound so much better? I'm going to intervene. So like I'm gonna come into this moment and stop things. But yeah, so it's like a lot of these borrowings that happened here were not because we needed them.
Yeah.
It was just like fancy.
There's another one I'm gonna recommend to you, an old Kids in the Hall sketch, which is just fantastic. It's these guys at a mechanic shop or something like that. And the boss comes in to talk to this guy and he says, hey, I got something I got to share with you. You're making a lot of the guys feel uncomfortable with how much you're using the word ascertain. He's like, the guy rubs his chin. He's like, if I can ascertain what you're telling me, and then it just keeps going from there. It's wonderful.
That's amazing. So yes, have to watch that too. Another word we got during this time was celebrate, which was borrowed again from Latin. And it really just, it was like more about honoring someone, and that's how we use it now. I pulled this one out just because I like it. Because isn't celebrate a good word?
Because you were thinking of the British celebratory.
Oh my gosh, that throws me off every time I hear it on the Great British Bake Off.
Feels like they're making a joke, like just saying something cute, and it's like, no, that's how they say
Celebratory.
that.
Also, I think I was in my head singing Celebrate Good Times. Come on. And so I was like, we're putting this in there.
Oh yeah, this is a good one.
The next one?
Yeah, I see the next
Yeah,
one.
the next one is Decimate. And the reason I put it in there is because it literally is supposed to have originally been used to refer to like taking a tenth of something. So, like, really, if you're tithing, you're decimating your storehouses, right? You're taking a tenth of it and giving it away. But it, and oh, yeah, that's actually right there in the origin. Look at that. The term decimation denoted the levying of a tithe, which is again about 10%, later referred to a tax. And now it refers to like completely leveling something. It's decimated.
So then I guess I now have a question because I want to know if what I heard was a folk tale and not true. I heard that in Latin, decimare, decimate, right, was used as when there was when this a company, a Latin company of Roman soldiers had done something wrong. They punished the company by randomly taking one out of every 10 of them and killing them. And it was a way to really make sure nobody did anything because it was totally random and so therefore terrifying.
I do believe it had something to do with the practice of killing a tenth of something. Like I think that I don't know if that's precisely correct, but I do think that that has some merit there. And that may also be, you're right, like why is suddenly decimate referred to like total destruction because it's like it's so scary. The next one is repeat. Which, just means to do again or hear. It actually came from Latin meaning, to seek, and it has that re prefix, which means back, which we then use to like, we now just use the re prefix in English, right? Like redo, re-say, rewrite, re whatever. But one of the reasons I pulled this word out is because at the same time that we're borrowing the word repeat, it's like, why not also borrow iterate? Which means repeat. So we borrow both of those. Kind of mean the same thing. But at the same time, iterate just didn't sound repetitive enough. And so we turned it into reiterate because why not? And so it's like iterate and reiterate actually mean the same thing. It's just, it feels more reinforced. Speaking of re. But yeah, that's what happened with these inkhorn terms, though, is like, it wasn't really necessarily understood how they were used in Latin or how they were used in whatever language they were borrowed from. And it's like, but it sounds cool and we're going to make this work. And it sort of took on a life of its own. And so those are some inkhorn terms examples. Again, all borrowed because of prestige.
I know, but it's crazy that some of these then took on, irregular past tenses. So you have reiterate and then reiterote.
I believe that's reiterat.
I don't know. That's the past participle reiterotten.
Reiteratin. That's yes, that is it. Yeah, it's kind of interesting. Like as you start really looking at etymologies to see which words that feel so regular in English were actually borrowed really relatively late, in terms of, like the overall history of the English language. Well, up until now anyway. And so it's like there are certain words where it just feels like, oh, that word must be ancient. That must go way back. And then you find out that no, it was actually borrowed, 16th century. And again, 16th century, that's when we're starting to get into where you draw that line for like where modern English begins. And so this takes us into a more modern English era. And then we get more borrowing because of new experiences, new things. And this is another reason that languages borrow. So you could, of course, incorporate borrowing just because your speakers like the word that they hear in another language and they're going to use it. But also this next one, like, it just makes more logical sense, because it's like, if you have a speaking community that moves from one place to another, and there's already another speaking community there, and they start experiencing new things in nature, they see new things, that new weather patterns, all these new things that happen because you're suddenly in a new place. If the other language speakers that are there have a word for it, then yeah, it gets borrowed quite often. That's what happens a lot. And so that happened in English as well. Some of the new experiences, though, are a bit more meta. And this actually made me think of our mice, because we're talking about like science and math and like new concepts that they would come up with. And David has something he wants to say, or he has a sneeze building up. I don't know.
No, it's a little aside. Mm-hmm. I was reminded of this because I forgot about this lovely character. But in talking about borrowing new things and borrowing from Latin, you might, if you're looking at the screen, if not, you're going to have to go to the YouTube video and mm-hmm. take a look. You'll see in between the science and math words, the ampersand. Mm-hmm. And it might look a little funny. That doesn't look the way ampersands usually do. But it is actually etymologically accurate, given mm-hmm. the rest of the font, because the ampersand is actually just the Latin word et,
yes,
which means and, written in kind of a fancy script, so that it's a big E and a little T, and they're kind of written together, and they just merge. And in fact, if you look at the Langtime font, there's an E right to the left of it there, and mm-hmm. you can see the E in the ampersand there. The T for math, it's pretty much the same. It's just yeah. brought down a little bit. And so it says et. And so it isn't a traditional ampersand. But it's like, that was one of those things where when I learned that, it absolutely blew my mind. Because like when I started writing ampersands, I didn't know what the heck that symbol was.
Well, sure.
And my ampersands ended up looking up a lot more like treble clefs.
Yeah.
And I've kind of stuck with it to this day. But it's like, if you think of it as like, oh, it's just writing a script E-T, there you go.
Well, and there are a couple of different sort of, infographics, memes, whatever, that you can find online that actually show the evolution of the two major forms of the ampersand.
Mm.
One of which is like the sort of curly E with a line through it, which you can kind of see et more easily knowing that that's et.
Yeah.
But then the other one, it actually shows the squirrely one that you find on keyboards. It shows that origin as well through like a completely different. So there's like two different ones you can look at. One that shows you the one that a lot of people in handwriting have. And then the other one that shows you the fancier one that you find on a lot of keyboards. And you can see these very different shapes came from the same source. And like, that's really cool. The word ampersand actually comes from the phrase and per se and. And so that's where it actually comes from. And over time, it actually just got reduced to that and per se became ampers. And then you got the other and in there. So ampersand comes from that.
And yet it didn't reduce further.
No.
Still a pretty complex
word. It's a very complex word. Mm-hmm. Okay. So one of the types of new experiences that English speakers had in the early modern English stages was this expansion of science and math knowledge, where new terms were needed because it's like, this is something we've never discussed before, and now we need to be able to call it something in the language. Unlike our mice, who started creating just words to like cover what it was, a lot of words ended up getting borrowed from Greek and Latin roots. They weren't necessarily words in Greek or Latin, actually, but it's called sort of a scientific Greek or scientific Latin, where it's like the parts, they used the parts and built new words from them to actually create something that looks like it's a Latin or Greek word that never would have been used when it was spoken. And so like one area was again science. And so for instance, the word biology comes from Greek bios, meaning life. And then the ology part is like study of, so study of life. And this word wasn't really created until about the 18th century. And it was actually based on Latin words and uses of borrowed Greek. And so a lot of this comes through Latin, even though a lot of words end up being traced back to Greek. As you know, scientists are exploring the universe and like getting methods to like actually like look at things like microscopes and seeing the world and all the little tiny pieces that are in it. Again, names were needed. And so, you know, a word like cellular, talking about cellular biology and so on, words like that came about in this one in particular in the early 18th century. Again, from what was called modern Latin. In other words, again, this sort of Latin being applied for academic uses where no speaker of Latin back in the day would have actually used it. This particular word, though, came from something meaning little chamber. So it's just the diminutive of chamber,
That
cella.
was the early 18th century,
Yeah.
the early 1700s.
Yeah.
They knew what cells were.
You know, I don't know how specifically they understood what it was, but they were talking about it. So it's like they knew there was something. I don't know how specifically they had it mapped out quite yet, but a lot of scientific discoveries, you may be surprised if you really dig into sort of that natural history of science knowledge. How far back some of these discoveries go. And the fact that people knew that they existed is kind of mind-blowing, even if they knew something existed because of mathematical principles, not because of like they hadn't seen it yet with their own eyes. But that's the same way with like astronomy. Like they figured out that there had to be a planet in a certain place, but they couldn't see it with their naked eye, but they just figured it out because of like a certain rotation and a pull of something. And like it's like how were people this brilliant? I guess how are they? There are still brilliant things going on.
They also, that was another one of those places where this happens a lot in language where we don't really understand something, so we come up with some sort of a rule, like, say, universal grammar that doesn't actually make any sense. But that's just because we don't know as much. And so there was this thing in astronomy called epicycles, I think it was. But basically, what they saw in the sky was that the planets, they would have, this orbit, right? But at a certain point in time, it looked like they were going backwards. And so what they reasoned was that the planets would be going in an oval shape, and then they would go on a little bitty oval up here and then go back on
Oh,
there.
like a little tiny eight.
A tiny little eight.
Tiny little baby.
Because it's like they knew what was happening and didn't have any other explanations. They're like, well, this makes sense. But
I mean, you use what you have at the time to make your best guess. And then over on the math side, so if our numbers and how we write them, they're called Arabic numerals. And a part of that is because a lot of our math practices were actually from Arabic originally. And so we have words like algebra, which originally came from the Arabic language. Now we got this, English got it through a series of other languages. And so this one is actually an older word that had been used in medieval Latin, but then filtered through like Italian and Spanish before English got its hands on it. But algebra, the word, comes from Arabic. Would you say al-jabar? Is that
Al-Jabr.
there we go. The reunion of broken parts is what it breaks down to, which I think is like really cool because when you think about algebra and what you're doing with it, with all the equations and trying to figure out things. But it could also originally be used to refer to bone setting, which I was like, whoa, that's like kind of crazy. And it comes from this verb meaning to reunite or restore.
Jabara.
Nice. So originally it was like the surgical treatment of fractures, and that probably went through Spanish where it actually survives that way. So there's a Spanish word like that.
Really?
Well, that's what it says. It still survives. So I don't know the Spanish word. See if you can figure that out. The mathematical sense of the word algebra, though, actually came from the title of a book, where maybe David can read this for me, the title of the book.
Oh, I don't know what that initial apostrophe is. Is that a glottal stop or is it a
Yeah, I think so. Or it
or
may be this, but like it just turned it into that.
Well, that one, I know what that is. But that one, if it's a glottal stop, it's ilm. However, if it's a pharyngeal approximant, that's ilm, So, but let's just say it's glottal stop in Maljabr wal Muqabala.
And so in this book title, you can translate it to something like The Science of Restoring What Is Missing and Equating Like with Like, was written by a mathematician, and it had algebra
Oh,
in the title.
that's the science?
Yeah.
Oh, that's probably his ilm. And it comes from alim, which is to know.
There you
That
go.
makes sense.
And so now David is looking up
Yeah, I want to find this
Yubara.
crazy algebra term from Spanish. And so, like, I'm going to go to Aljabr, and then I'm going to see what.
Can you reverse
Yeah.
etymology that?
Yeah,
Where
well,
it's
that's.
like.
I wanted to see what it was borrowed into. You know what I'm saying? And that's got to be somewhere at the bottom, right? Oh,
I don't know.
crap. It's going to Ottoman Turkish, darn
I didn't
it.
know that you could do it. But can you actually look up? This is what was the Jabarta. Can you look that up
Well,
instead?
sure. I mean, it's right there. Yeah, this is just the,
Oh, okay.
and it's to set a broken bone.
But like, actually, look
It'll.
up in Spanish Jabara and see if it means something. Yabara.
Well, it could have been borrowed in any number of ways. Hibara? Hibara? Hibar?
Hibar.
To curve, to bend. No, that's not it.
Well, anyway,
I'm gonna keep looking.
this is something we can trace down later.
Oh yeah, I'm gonna look it up now.
All
So
right,
you
so
keep going.
these are new concepts. But of course there are other new things that speakers suddenly were introduced to that they needed words for. And so they borrowed from other languages that already had words for them. So you know, this is specific to a big era of exploration, and there was a lot of new flora and fauna. And of course, I use the term exploration very nicely because it wasn't always just exploration. It was also takeovers. But new flora and fauna were experienced, and David.
Oh, I was right. It was the, Alim.
Nice.
Yeah.
All right, so let's talk about some new things that they experienced in flora and fauna. Here's this cute little guy. If you're watching the video, there is a very cute little picture of a raccoon. And that was something new for English speakers. And so English speakers actually borrowed the word. This is, you know, an indigenous animal to the United States, or not United States, North America, I should say. Goodness, listen to me. And so they actually borrowed a word from an Algonquian language, which is spelled and pronounced quite differently than we do today. But the early English speakers were about as good acquiring Algonquian languages among other indigenous languages
Oh.
as I am.
Well,
So,
okay, so this thing is spelled Arouguhcun, right?
yeah.
And forgetting how the consonants are, if that was something like, you know, a raccoon or something like, or a raccoon, the A probably got dropped because they thought it was an article.
Yeah.
A
And then,
raccoon.
right,
Yeah.
and then the other sounds got reduced to what they could pronounce.
Yeah.
Which, again, is about as good as what I could pronounce. Another animal indigenous to North American regions that they didn't have a word for was a moose. This, by the way, there's a dictionary like redefining moose because they call it ungainly and people were upset about that. And so they're like trying to redefine it so that way it doesn't use the word ungainly at their long legs. And the word moose was borrowed from Eastern Abnaki. I'm not sure the pronunciation here. It's just spelled M-O-S. It could be moose or something similar. But yeah, that was borrowed into English as moose. It wasn't just in North America that new things were encountered in terms of flora and fauna. Over in Australia, the kangaroo was a new interaction, a new creature. And that was borrowed. It was the name of a specific kind of kangaroo in an Aboriginal language of North Queensland. It is a myth. as far as I know, that the word kangaroo started out by somebody being like, what is that? And the answer being, I don't know. And it was just kangaroo, where kangaroo meant I don't know. And they just started using it. That is a myth.
Yeah.
It was actually the name of a specific kind of kangaroo. Probably, again, pronounced quite differently, but that's how it came into English. Another animal was this cute little guy hanging on to a tree, a koala. And this was borrowed from, and I actually don't know how to say the language name. I don't know if it's Dharuk or like Dahruk, but it's Dharuk. I don't know.
Is it Australian?
Yeah.
Maybe that's how they do the retroflex one. I don't know.
Oh, Dharuk. Maybe. Another one, this guy who... Just looks so funny, is an aardvark. And one of the reasons I specifically chose aardvark is because it was borrowed from South African Dutch, which it's a borrowing, and it breaks down to the compound of earth pig. But English also calked this word, and that's where we get the word groundhog. But we applied it to a completely different animal. But again, it's a calking, and that's where you borrow a word but translate it into your own language. And so it's like some people claim that in Spanish you can have a hot dog, you can have a perro caliente. Some people claim that. I don't know
perro
if that's
caliente
true.
Yeah, I've heard it.
Okay. So like that was a calking of the English hot dog. Speaking of hot dogs, other new experiences included food, a lot of which came from flora. So now we'll get into that flora half too, because a lot of things, a lot of new foods were things that you could eat or use for cooking, including this gorgeous herb, thyme. And so that was actually borrowed from French, but it's actually a Greek word in origin. And it comes from a verb meaning to burn or sacrifice.
Oh.
And so it's like Greek, but like then Latin borrowed it. Then, of course, French had it because Latin had it. And then English borrowed it from French. Another borrowing was for a spice. So we got a lot of herb and spices ended up being borrowed because I swear Anglo-Saxon food must have been very bland. Like they didn't have much by way of herbs and spices. And so quite a bit of these words are borrowed, including cinnamon. This one was also borrowed through Old French, but came from, again, another sort of Greek through Latin borrowing. But this actually came from a Semitic language and may have even been based on a word from Malay. And so the origins here are a bit iffy, but they're old and they go way back. And then both Greek and Latin ended up borrowing this word from a Semitic language. And it just came into English as cinnamon. One of those words that I had troubles with as a kid, because it was, of course, cinnamon to me.
Oh.
Oh, I know the one that my sister always thinks was the cutest. One of my food words as a kid that I could not say correctly for the life of me. For whatever reason, I could not say the word hamburger, and it came out as hang-a-burger. And so I always wanted a hang-a-burger.
Oh.
This area gets into some of David's favorites.
El cahua.
Not that he drinks it. Really, but he loves the flavor of coffee, and that is another borrowing, because you know there was no coffee before a certain point. And this one was actually borrowed from Turkish, but it originally came from Arabic, and so Arabic kahwa.
Yeah, Arabic el kahwa.
And then Turkish had it kahve, and then. We probably got it from Dutch, is probably how English got it, for the Dutch word koffie.
By the way, that's the same way that, Finnish does F intervocalically.
Yes, which we learned from the word sofa.
Sofa.
Yes. Oh, how fun. speaking of coffee, though, a lot of our coffee words are borrowed, including espresso, We got this one from Italian. Got a lot of good words from Italian. And this one literally means like pressed out coffee is what espresso means, because it was a shortening of cafe espresso, where espresso is the pressed out bit. And then we just stopped calling it cafe espresso. We just started calling it espresso. Another type of drink, an espresso drink, is a latte, which we also borrowed from Latin and was cafe latte, but we dropped the cafe yet again. And so we call it a latte, which really just means milk. And so that's, I want a milk, but really what you want is a milked coffee. And then finally, this last one was one that we actually discovered during a stream. Mocha was borrowed from a place name where it was a port in Yemen on the Red Sea where coffee and leather were first shipped. And so we actually got that from a completely different place, which is really cool. David's still looking up the Spanish word, by the way.
I can't find this word. To say the set a bone, you use, you know, poner hueso to set it. But now I'm finding out that albóndiga comes from Arabic, and I don't know why I didn't guess that since it starts with al, but you know, albóndigas are such, you know, I don't know. They're such like, you know, common things for me growing up. I didn't realize apparently came from the Arabic for hazelnut.
And it's a meatball, by the way, in case like me, you were like, yes. A what? It's a meatball, but it came from the word for hazelnut in Arabic, which is really fun.
Yeah, it's cute. Anyway, I'm not finding this word.
Okay. Well, I just said it still survives. That's what the etymology said. I don't know.
I wonder if grandma would know it. She's texted me.
Well, we'll tease that out later. So we've covered some animals, some plants, some food things, but another area of expanding vocabulary was in clothes and fashion. And like materials and different techniques for making clothes and so on. And so, yeah, clothes and fashion brought in new words, again, often borrowed from the place where the thing was borrowed from. And so, for instance, like we got espressos from the concept from Italy. And so we took their word for it. And for example, we have lace, which is actually related to the same root that gives us lasso, which I think is great. This one was borrowed from French. And so I think English speakers were introduced to the material of lace probably around the time when, you know, like the French probably would have introduced that material, that kind of concept, the way that you make the lacing was probably introduced at that time. So the verb and the noun in Old French that English borrowed it from was actually based on the Latin laceus, meaning noose, which was also an early sense in English. So I was like, that took a dark turn. That was really interesting while I was researching that one. Another material that was new was satin, because of course there was no satin once upon a time for those dear Anglo-Saxons. And satin was introduced during late Middle English stages. And this was another borrowing through French, but the word itself was actually borrowed from Arabic, but it was actually from a name of a town in China. And so like the Arabic word meant of Xinjiang, which is a town in China. And then Old French borrowed the Arabic word, and then that's how English got it.
That's crazy, because the Arabic word looks a lot like the Arabic word for olive.
Zaytuni.
I don't know what the E on the end there is, but zaytun is the word for olive in Arabic. That's pretty wild. By the way, since she texted me, I did ask my grandmother. We'll see, though. I don't know if I'm going to be able to explain. I explained it as best I could to her that I was looking for a word that sounded like algebra, that has something to do with setting a bone.
David's grandma is going to be so confused.
She's going to be very confused.
But she's going to try her darndest to figure out how to answer you. Oh, it is related to olive.
Oh.
But it's a phonosemantic matching of the Chinese writing system.
Whoa.
For this town name. Oh my God, that is crazy.
You know what that reminds me of? It reminds me of calling Köln Cologne, you know?
Yeah, where that makes no sense.
Yeah.
In this one, so this is the name of the town that I had was Tsinkyang, but the one here was Kwangju. But the writing system would be the same whether you're reading it in Mandarin or Cantonese.
Well, I mean, sing song.
Right, but then an
An
old
old
name
name
for
for.
Kwangju.
Okay, so this is just the modern one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So satin, a really cool origin, apparently also olive.
Yeah.
And then cotton was also a new, and that one was another one borrowed from Arabic
Yep.
originally. And so again, filtered through French. A lot of our fashion words ended up being filtered through French before English borrowed them, in the same way all of our coffee drinks are filtered through Italy first. And so yeah, that was another one. And then of course my favorite material, jeans.
Yep.
This one again from French, but this because of a place name. So it was a place. And so this one, it says it's from medieval Latin, basically Genoa, which was the original production area of jean material. And so it started out as a place name. We use it as an adjective. We have to pluralize it to use it as like the thing we wear because probably because we do the same thing to pants. Maybe because it has more than one leg. I don't know. I don't know. It's kind of fun. But
Fastgen.
yeah, like, how would you say that in French?
Oh, that's a French term?
I believe so.
Jean Fustien?
Maybe.
I mean, but the S, you wouldn't, that wouldn't be in that position in French. It would become a U with a little hat on it,
Oh,
and it would
then
be
maybe it
Fustien.
was Latin. But it literally was fustian from Genoa, so I don't know what fustian is. That's, I
Don't
guess, some kind of
either.
material. It was a heavy twilled cotton cloth was the original jean material that, gave rise to what we now refer to as jeans. And speaking of jeans, the word dungaree or dungarees in the plural, depending on how you use it, was actually a borrowing from Hindi. And so dungri, which was, so you can call them dungarees. Some people call them overalls. They're also called bibs. They're also called, so it's like that style is something that we have a lot of different words for now. But it was popularized with English speakers, in India. And so that's where we got it. But also speaking of gene type things, a good old Western theme in the North American regions, we get chaps, which was a borrowing from Mexican Spanish. And it actually comes from the word, you can say it much better than I can.
Chaparreras.
Beautiful, which is like dwarf evergreen oaks. And so they called this material that because it protected you from these dwarf evergreen oaks, which have like thorny vegetation. And so it ended up like it's what it protected. Yes.
Sorry.
So the chaps, the thing you wear over your jeans to protect you from the vegetation, got its name from the vegetation.
Man, and that's a Tarjay pronunciation. Chaparral.
Good job, baby.
I mean, really, though, like if we were just borrowing that straight from Spanish, it would either be a chaparral or a chaparral. You know? How on earth did we get chaparral?
I don't know. I don't know. But I do know, like, we called the clothing, we just shortened it to chaps. Got your chaps. And so those are some new clothing words. Exciting stuff. And beyond that, of course, there were new experiences, concepts, etc. So I was in like this like chaps frame of thinking. And so I was like, oh, our word ranch actually came from Spanish as well. But I love its origin because it like from Spanish rancho, meaning a group of people eating together. And then that was used to refer to ranches where, like, you work together, you eat together, and that's our modern concept of what a ranch is.
That's what that means in Spanish? That's what it originally means? Hold on a sec, that's English. From rancharse, to get ready. Oh, yeah. Oh, from French. Oh, ranger. So it comes from the same thing that range does.
So to arrange oneself.
Oh, I was thinking like home on the range, more
oh,
like.
Yeah, that. Well, that too, but that's literally the definition provided here.
Oh, with the reflexive, yeah.
Oh, my gosh. It comes from the root ring, which we would have gotten ring, right?
Yeah. And so this is actually the fourth definition, mass mealtime.
Nice.
Yeah.
Well, apparently
a la
they
hora
say
del rancho. Oh, okay. So that the time of eating. Chateando en el barro, nos acercamos a las ollas.
David's reading a Spanish quote now.
And that one's from 1926. So that makes sense. That makes sense. It probably something that was much more common at that time than it is now.
Right. This is also another great example of how, like, it can mean something in one language and be used in a totally different language with a very specific meaning. And so, like, that was just one definition of ranchos or rancho in Spanish, and yet that's the sense that it was borrowed from, which is really cool. Another word that was borrowed in was cargo. And so, like, as you know, ship travel became sort of how explorations happened across oceans, this word was actually borrowed, another borrowing from Spanish, cargo, which was from Latin caricare, meaning to load. And that came from Latin carus, meaning wheeled vehicle. And so I love that cargo, which we often associate with ships, came from a word meaning wheeled vehicle. I thought that was pretty fun. David's texting his grandma again.
Now she thinks I'm making a joke. But she says, like, and about the word, it's not coming to my mind right now. Which is it? And I'm like, And so I'm trying to say, like, evidently it's a word that came from Arabic where
Well, you think about how you're going to text your grandma. I want to finish this presentation.
Right. How do you say meaning in Spanish?
No idea.
I'm getting lost because I'm just going to write it in English. ¿Dónde tiene el meaning? Significación. That's what I'm...
Okay. Well, I'm going to keep going forward with borrowings and some cool things that happen.
Sorry, you got to do it.
All right. So another area was scholarship. Like, as we're thinking about new experiences and new ways to think about the world, there were some new academic terms that were borrowed in. And the examples I'm about to give, quite a few of them, if not all of them, were from German. But ones that I'm like, it's just so funny that these show up in like spelling bees and stuff, because it's like they're English words, except it's like Weltanschauung. And it's pronounced that way because we're like, we try to be all like, we can pronounce German words. But this is borrowed from German for like, it means like a world outlook or a world perception. And it's used in sort of meta discussions about how we view the world. And so.
Oh, gosh. I'm so embarrassed if you're seeing this. I clearly did not.
The LT.
Yeah, I did not. Kern those properly. I'm so sorry. It's supposed to be one word, not two words.
Well, Tanshaung.
Oh, I'm so embarrassed.
As you should be. One of my favorite examples of borrowings into English is Schadenfreude.
Mm-hmm.
And that's another, again, German word that came in, meaning it essentially means like that sense you get of joy from other people having a bad go of it. And so it's really anyone who likes to watch reality TV has a bit of Schadenfreude in them because they enjoy watching people have a hard time.
Not me.
And then Gestalt is another one that gets used like in philosophy and psychology quite a bit, where it's like it literally means form or shape. So Talk about Gestalt as in like the whole of something. So yeah, it's like as you're thinking about borrowings and expanding, vocabulary, coming across new things, but also new ways of thinking. Also, like if a certain wave of like th this came out of a wave of philosophical thinking and writings that were very popular, beginning with German philosophers and psychologists. And they got borrowed, like the terms they created in their own language just got straight up borrowed into English from academics. And then finally, the last area I'm going to talk about is borrowings from literature. So words that you can actually borrow from stories that are in other languages. And specifically, the ones that I knew of that, right off the top of my head were biblical borrowings. So from biblical stories, including our word shibboleth, which is really just a Hebrew word that means like ear of corn. But in Judges, in the book of Judges, there's this story about how this word was used as a test of nationality because like these two opposing groups were across a river and like they wanted to make sure that nobody came across the river who didn't belong on their side. And so one of the things that the story says is they would have the people pronounce this word before they could get into the encampment. And if they said it shibboleth, they knew that they were not of their group because they said shibboleth with that fricative at the end. And so if they didn't say that fricative at the end, they would kill them because they knew they were an outsider.
That's
So
just like Jif.
Jif and Gif. And so now when you use the term shibboleth, what you're referring to is the act of having something that distinguishes an outsider. And so like a shibboleth is just something that shows that you are not part of the in group. It doesn't refer to the killing of them anymore. But again, the word itself just means ear of corn. Nothing fancy there. Another biblical borrowing was the name Nimrod. Which this one was from Genesis, and so it was the name of a great grandson of Noah, and he was known for his skill as a hunter. And so this was borrowed into English to refer to great hunters. Now you may be saying, but wait a second, that's not how I use the word Nimrod. And that's because of Bugs Bunny. Because Bugs Bunny referred to Elmer Fudd as a Nimrod, but like in a sort of sarcastic way, because Elmer Fudd was not a good hunter, but he would be like, "Oh, you Nimrod," to be like, "Oh, you great hunter." But like kids watching had no idea what a Nimrod was. And so the kids watching thought, "Oh, Nimrod means like someone who kind of bumbles along, who's not very good." And like that changed. And a generation of TV watching kids hearing Nimrod, it suddenly became like a very different meaning. And so, yeah, I found this meme online, which really just cracked me up, where it's like, who would win? And on the one hand, it's like the mighty hunter king of Shinar who commissioned the construction of the Tower of Babel. And he did. That was Nimrod.
Oh my goodness.
And then on the other hand, one wascally wabbit. And the wabbit has won out.
Yeah, so that would be the type of thing where it's like if you saw this guy playing basketball and you wanted to deride his abilities and say, "Well, ho, look who we have here, LeBron James. How are you doing?" And the joke would be, "Of course you're not LeBron James, you're not as good as him, and you're saying that to make it sound as if this person is trying to be good." But then imagine if it's 500 years in the future, and very few people know who LeBron James was anymore. Suddenly, it'd be like, what does this mean? Is that just a word you use to make fun of people who aren't good at basketball? Or just to make fun of them generally? That's essentially what happened with old Nimrod.
Good old Nimrod.
Isn't that incredible, though? Like, you can't do anything about your legacy. You can become a joke in the future. You can't stop it.
But I love also that sort of Conlang connection because, the passage of the Tower of Babel ends up getting used quite a bit. God, David almost threw a water bottle. All right, so that concludes my really quick overview of some of the many different waves of borrowing that English has had. There are a lot of ways you can talk about the history of the English language, and I'm not joking, I could go on and on and on and on about different areas within English history because I am fascinated by it. I really like to study it. I loved teaching it. And so it's like this is an area I could just go on and on about. But I chose to focus on borrowing specifically for these podcast episodes because someone had asked, for more, just more examples of how borrowing can happen in languages and to get inspiration for conlanging. And so I hope you see like just how diverse borrowing can be. Please note that not all languages borrow as liberally as English has and continues to do. And so it's okay, even if your conlang speakers are regularly in contact with another, language speaking community, that doesn't mean they're going to borrow as much as English ever did. It may mean that they get like a very specific word or, like some place names or something like that. And that's okay if the borrowings are kept to a minimum. English speakers, historically, for whatever reason, have just been very open and welcoming to new words in the language. And so there are many different waves of borrowing, and they're so diverse from different languages, from different groups, that it's like, again, like I said, you could just keep going on and on and on about this topic. If you are interested in the history of the English language, I have some book recommendations for you. So, a little recommended reading. One that I find just a delightful read is called Inventing English, A Portable History of the English Language. And it just gives a nice overview. It's something that I find very reader friendly, very accessible. It's by Seth Lehrer, Lerer, is his last name. And it's again called Inventing English, and it's something that if you're just interested in getting sort of a condensed history of the language, you can jump in and read that. So that is one recommendation. Another recommendation I have is called The Lexicographer's Dilemma by Jack Lynch. And this one also looks at history of English language, but like really focusing on word meaning and how words are used and how society reacts to certain words and uses of them. And so like it's really cool because it looks at sort of the evolution of societal attitudes toward English language and certain borrowings and the ways that words get used and so on. So it ends up giving you a history, but like sort of through it, the lens of societal attitude, if you will. And so that's another book that I just really enjoy reading. It's a bit denser, but I think it's really, really cool. Another one that I enjoy is called The Secret Life of Words, and it's How English Became English by Henry Hitchings. And this one sort of like zooms in on particular words and gives you like snapshots of their histories for how they were borrowed into English at the same time as weaving like a whole story about English and how it became the language it is today. And so again, like the last three books will all give you a lot of information about the history of English, but in really different ways and through different lenses. And quite honestly, you could read all three of them and get just brand new information out of all of them. So I highly recommend all three. And then finally, my last one, I am going to recommend a book if you're curious for more historical reasons to better understand the history of the time and the speakers. There's this book called The Year 1000, What Life Was Like at the Turn of the First Millennium, and it's by Robert Lacey and Danny Danziger. And this book, it is divided into at least 12 chapters. There may be more, but it's at least 12 chapters because the chapters take you through a month in the year 1000. So it's like what would commonly happen in January, what kinds of things would happen in February, and so on. And so it really just describes like daily life as best historians know daily life in the year 1000. And I think it's a really cool companion book to reading about the history of English because, like, it really helps you better understand that Old English to Middle English transition in terms of just understanding what life was like and like what their daily needs were, what they may have been talking about, what they saw, how they built their homes, how they got their food, and so on. And so it's just, and it just is sort of eye-opening because it's, you don't, I necessarily think about what daily life was like for somebody living 1,000 years ago. And it's so different from what we experience now that it was like a really cool thing to be able to connect that to language use and how they may have talked about the world. And so that's my last book recommendation.
Well, a really good book recommendation, though, would be the book that you wrote for the class that you taught on the history of English.
I didn't write a book for that one.
You didn't?
No.
How did you do it?
I used a lot of combinations of these books, in fact.
Wow, really?
Yeah.
Hmm.
Among others, I have read so many books for the history of the English language. It would take quite a while to list them all that I have read and that I have ended up using in teaching of the class. Because I mean, I
Man,
taught it for a decade, so
I
I
know.
used a lot of books.
Yeah, it's really impressive. And something that I think, especially for people who watch us stream, something that I really think they need to know and appreciate and understand is that I'm not a good scholar. I really didn't read many books, and I'm very bad at research, and I also don't like it. Jesse is very much the opposite of that.
It's also just as a fun aside, when I was hired at SFA, I had never studied the history of the English language before. And yet, one of the things that I was going to have to be teaching when I got hired there was history of the English language. And they were like, you're going to need to teach this. It was not an area because really, all I had studied, like I really focused on English, so like my studies were on the English language, no problem. But I didn't study the history of it. And so like I could tell you all sorts of grammatical phenomena that happened in modern English, but I couldn't tell you where words came from and whatnot. And so that's where I started my own crash course in, well, now I need to figure out the history of English. And so I essentially taught myself everything I was going to need to teach my students in, the 6 months leading up to my first semester of teaching it. And I never stopped being fascinated by it. And so honestly, this was one of those things where it didn't feel like work to research for teaching this class, and it didn't feel like work as I kept trying to find new books for my students to use in class. I was always fascinated by it. And so like I love getting my hands on different books just to see like, ooh, do they have a different take on this? Do they have a different angle that I haven't thought about yet? I find it very fascinating.
Yeah, every so often in life you're presented with these opportunities where it's like somebody assumes that you can do something or tells you that you're going to do something that you just don't know anything about. And you always have the opportunity to say, you know what? No, I've never done that. I'm not capable of doing that. Or you could just say, yeah, I'll do that. And then you just learn it. When I got into UC San Diego, the phonology professor there actually contacted me. This is before I even knew I got in, saying that he had been planning to put together a course on created languages and wanted to know if I would help out. And I said, yeah, it sounds amazing. And he said, yeah, and you can take care of the all the web stuff. You're younger, so I don't know much about that. First of all, that wasn't true. Second of all, he wasn't very old. And third of all, I knew nothing about anything having to do with the web at all. I'd used a blog before, not even LiveJournal. It was before that. So basically I said, yeah, I'll do that. And I just taught myself HTML and CSS in 3 months. And from there on after that, I just kept teaching myself how to make websites. And now I know how to do it.
Nice. And now I can talk forever about the history of English language. Yay. All right. Well, that is the end of this episode and the end of this topic for, as much as I could talk about it, we're not going to turn this podcast into an English language history podcast. But thank you for listening along. Hope that you heard some things that you may have found interesting, inspiring, or otherwise cool. And yeah, we will look forward to chatting with you next month in Lang Time Chat.
Yeah, also just to let you know, my grandma clearly does not know what this word is. So that's still an open question. We're gonna have to find out
We'll figure this
what
mystery out.
this mysterious Spanish word is and if anybody's heard of
All
it.
right. Well, we hope you all have a great start of April. Never mind. I'll tell David after I end the stream. I just thought of something. Anyway, hope you all have a great start of April and stay grammar.
Bye, everybody.